the life of Elisha. And as we enter more and more into his life and into his ministry, I think we find him to be a very special person. But I suppose it is because Elijah, we remember him particularly for things perhaps that speak very much to us, his Cherith, and also Mount Carmel, and the confrontation with Jezebel, Ahab and Jezebel. And in a way, this is a quiet ministry, and yet there is something so precious and so wonderful. You cannot say that they are different. They serve the same God with the same Spirit. And yet the task that they have to do is quite different, and mostly some points are rather similar. Now then, here we have a miracle, and then we have how conscious Elisha was of God's protection. I'd like to do both. I'm not very sure if we'll get that far. Now, the account opens with these sons of prophets that we have come across numerous times now, in the time of Elijah, and certainly in the transition period between Elijah and Elisha, and how they recognize who he is, and the various relationship we have. They seem to be good men, and they serve God. And we have a situation here in this first few verses where they're running short of room. It's an ordinary kind of situation, but from it arises something that brings out a principle. Now, I hardly need read the verses again, but they go to Jordan, and every man taking his share of work to do, and they've chosen their location. And they go according to Elisha's wishes. They say in verse 1, they set unto Elisha. So the situation is one that involves Elisha himself. And they asked him to go with them. And so he went, and they came to Jordan, and they cut down wood. But then something happens, and it's such a very ordinary thing which we can so easily relate to ourselves. It involves one of the prophets. But as one was felling a beam, this is verse 5, the axe head fell into the water. And he cried and said, "Alas, master, for it was borrowed." I've so often looked at various times upon that verse. I think it's one of the verses that struck me, because the first time I saw it, I'd never really noticed it before. And I think if you find that kind of verse, it stays in your mind afterwards as quite a striking one. "For it was borrowed," and he is very distressed. And the man of God helps him. He said, "Where did it fall? Where fell it?" He showed him the place, and he cut down a stick and cast it in thither, and the iron did swim. "Therefore," said he, "take it up to thee," and he put out his hand and he took it. And that is the end of the story, and a happy ending to it. And yet, if we just passed by and didn't say anything at all, I wouldn't want that. We've all written sermons on this, I suppose, but I don't want to do it like that. I rather want to look at it as it is. When something is borrowed, we have a very special responsibility. And it seems to me that very often when you borrow something, if something's going to go wrong, it will go wrong then. It seems to be like that. And you wish you could unborrow it and buy something new and lashed out and spent some money so not to be embarrassed. I'm not very sure whether this person will say, "Well, it doesn't matter." And the way they say it doesn't matter, you know that it does. And you feel you'd like to replace it. They said, "Oh, no, I wouldn't think of it." And you don't forget about it because you feel very, very embarrassed about it, a borrowed thing. And this person has that kind of sensitivity. It is an accident, that's all it is. And it has a happy ending to it. But you can bring serious things from it too. Let me read you a few verses. Something that perhaps we should all be aware of before I go on to perhaps a very lovely account there. "What about my life? our days, the number of our days. Would you agree, in a sense we can say we live, well, if not on borrowed time, on time permitted, the time God gives us for this life. There are various references, well-known ones, the God in whose hand thy breath is, as in Daniel. Will you just pause upon that for a moment, and how we can waste our breath on silly talk very often, and silly things. We get breathless about all sorts of things, don't we? And to remember the breath that I have it from God, and really it's by his permission that I enter into a new day. Another one, which is quoted in Acts from the from some other source, in whom we live and move and have our being. These verses are those that show a recognition that the time and the days that we have are by God's mercy and by God's grace. In Psalm 90, of course, we're familiar with verse 9, for all our days are passed away in thy wrath. We spend our years as a tale that is told. In the psalmist there, Moses is writing, he says, life seems so brief and it's gone so quickly. And the original Hebrew there is very interesting. The Authorized Version is a wonderful translation, and there's nothing wrong with it at all. It's expressing a word that's very difficult to convey, and it's the word sigh. We spend our lives, our years, as a sigh. There's something very thoughtful about that, isn't it? Like a tale that is told, like the words that are spoken, like an act that is finished and gone, like a sign. So you might ask from one point of view to God, say, well, what do you think of the length of my life, Lord? And he said, you know, really, as far as the platform and the background of eternity is concerned, it hardly registered. It was a sigh. And in another verse, it says that we are like a blade of grass. I'll read that in a moment. Well, it's Psalm 90. It develops this by saying, the days of our years are 70 years. And if, by reason of strength, they be 80 years, yet is their strength labor and sorrow, for it is soon cut off, and we fly away. So he's emphasizing the same thing. Whether we are worried or bothered about the figure 70 on it, it doesn't really matter. What he's saying is there is a span of time that is, generally speaking, the span of your strength. It is true that you may go further. I think sometimes I must have used this before, because I look at it every year. Outside our window there are some trees, some lovely trees. I love them in all their moods. I love the birds in spring and the full blossom, or whatever, the beauty of the leaves in midsummer, and of course the lovely colours of autumn, and then the barrenness of winter. There's something beautiful about the tracery that they make, and the patterns that they make with their little twigs and their little branches and so on. And right about now, the leaves are having a hard time, and they're going, and it's a gust of wind that takes a whole heap of them away. And then there comes a time with one tree opposite, which I am kind of particularly friendly or interested in. I don't talk to it, by the way, as some do, but I look at it, and there's about a dozen leaves left sometimes, and they really are tough little things. They really are. And then a gust of wind comes one night, and there are only 3 left, and these 3 are real little toughies. They've lost their beauty, they've lost their greenery, they've lost their autumn shades, and they're all crinkled. But they're still hanging on. And then often it comes down to one. And I say to myself, that one is going to make it till spring. Then I look up and it's gone. What I'm saying is, in the end, we all go. In the end. However strong we may be, or however much we may be proud of our strength. And in any case, it comes a time that it is troublesome to us. And in the same psalm, it says these words about the time that he gives us, which is borrowed, remember. So, in the light of that, of a sigh, or fourscore years, and so on, so teach us to number our days, that we may apply our hearts to wisdom. That's good, isn't it? Teach us, Lord, if we are thine, divine mathematics, and to consider that whatever length my days shall be, they are the days he has granted me. And in the light of that, how I should use them. Teach me to be wise. Now, how old were you when you were converted? I was 26. And I used to bemoan the fact that I hadn't been converted at 16. But you know, it's in his time, at the right time. And the important thing is that from that day, particularly from that day, that we realize these are most especially, we are bought, our lives are not our own. This really is his time, and we are his property. In Psalm 103, it's put like this, "For he knoweth our frame. He remembereth that we are dust. As for man, his days are as grass." And that's not very complimentary in a way, is it? Because grass is the most ordinary of things. You know, you could have said some exotic wildflower or something like that, but as grass, there's plenty of it about. There's nothing extraordinary about grass. It's so very, very ordinary. If somebody said, "Look at this field," I'm looking at it. Why you ask me, "Look at the grass"? Well, an artist is not going to paint a picture, is he, with just grass. There's nothing special about grass. He said, "But you are like that. And even your glory." Now, there is a little flower seen sometimes. I don't know its name, but it's a little tiny green little thing that appears sometimes, not in every blade of grass, but in some. And as a flower of the field, so he flourisheth for the wind. And then he says again, "For the wind passeth over it, and it is gone, and the place thereof shall know it no more." Now, what are all these for? James in the New Testament says, in James 4:14, he says, "Whereas ye know not what shall be on the morrow," and this is very much like Psalm 90, "for what is your life? It is even a vapour that appeareth for a little time and then vanisheth away." Now, if you left those verses like that, you could say, well, isn't that rather depressing? Now, all it's saying is, you don't live forever. All it's saying. And generally speaking, people do live, don't they? And indulge. As if they were going to live forever. And they're shocked at the thought of death. And that there is an end to living. It's outside their experience. Although they see it. And very often you find that you will not, well, some of you be, but I certainly am sometimes involved in a funeral that has nothing to do with any kind of Christian relationship or anything at all. And they usually all go to some public house or something afterwards. And I suppose try to eclipse or eliminate what they might be thinking in some way or another, because they cannot face up to it. But we don't mind it, do we? We can face up to it because we know something greater in the gospel, and we know of something that shall be given eternally for us. And that's a wonderful thing. But here he says to this man, he makes the iron swim. He says, "Take it. Take it." And I think that's a lovely little end to the story. And he take it up to thee, and he put it in his hand, and he took it. I don't want to make too much of that, or make too much of an account, although your person can develop this thing. It's as if you were saying, yes, this is borrowed time. That's true. And if that lesson is learnt, then take this. It's as if it's giving, in a way, if I may stretch this a little, life that shall endless be. Take it. That's a very wonderful thing. That it even begins now. You know, when we come to the Lord, before you came, what was important to you? And sadly, it can be important to us now. The things that everybody else is having, we think we have a right to them. We have no right to them, really. Some of you older ones are my age and older anyway, and I can't see many. We remember a book that came out with the InterVarsity Fellowship, and it was Have We... Or was it one of the missions? I'm not sure. Have We No Rights? Right, have we no rights? And the answer is no, we haven't. We have no right to say to God, I have a right to this. I have a right to be happy. I have a right for these things. No, we have no right to them all. It is by his mercy that we receive anything that we do have. And the more that we have, the greater is our responsibility. And the problem is, the more that we have, the more reluctant we are to see our responsibility. That's the sad thing of it. But anyway, when we come to realize, my days are in thy hands, I am thine, then you want that life to be real. Then if you come to that place where you are in Christ and in the gospel, then that picking up of that axe really transforms everything. I don't want to talk too much about the axe or use symbols like this. I'm just taking something out of it that may help us. And then a life. In our confession of faith, the first statement is this: the chief end of man is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. Now notice the difference? Forever. It removes that if by reason of strength thou shalt live sore, it shall be pain and sorrow. It removes that. Because running alongside our own life, in a way, is newness of life. And life that the grave cannot bury, that death cannot extinguish, life that shall endless be. And in a sense, I want you all to think for a moment of this, the time you came to the Lord. Now, certainly I appreciate the life before, and many lovely things, and many really wonderful people met, I know, and I'm grateful to you, and I'm grateful to them. I don't belittle that in any way. But in a real sense, my life began when he approached my little soul, and I came to him. It really began then. And if you think about it, that's how it really is. So we've begun something that has no end to it. But it's only a story of a little miracle here, and the relief of a little prophet who was very anxious about the head of an axe. But some people are not anxious about the borrowed time, and they use it carelessly. Do you remember I told you once on Sabbath day that where I saw this verse first time, I must have read it, and you know, you can read chapters and chapters and you don't remember all the verses, and then there comes an occasion when you do notice them. And it was in a funeral, it was in a cemetery, it was a Welsh service in the Cardiganshire. And I couldn't hear the minister who was taking the service. I was on the edge of the crowd, so I don't know the ways. I don't know why I did it. I suppose we all do it. I began to read the gravestones, you know, the various comments that I made. And on one in Welsh was, "Alas, Master, for it was borrowed." I often wondered, why did they put that? Was it for the person who had departed? They put this on my gravestone for others to think that we have borrowed time? Or was it maybe that a family feeling, he wasted his or her life, and for a warning to everyone else as they pass by, you are living on borrowed time. Alas, Master, for it was borrowed. Well, that's that. Let's go on, because we have plenty of time. Then the king of Syria... Now, this is our main thing tonight, really. Then the king of Syria warred against Israel and took counsel with his servants, saying, "In such and such a place shall be my camp." Now, let's notice everything here. The king is against... The king of Syria has come with his armies, or France comes with his armies, against Israel. And he takes counsel with his servants, saying, "In such and such a place shall be my camp." And they alone know this. And the man of God sent unto the king of Israel, saying, "Beware that thou pass not such a place, for thither the Syrians are come down." Now remember, he's a prophet, and notice that his knowledge is governed by God. Do you remember when that previous occasion, a knowledge was withheld from him? In that story of the distress of a person, the knowledge was withheld, but here the knowledge is given. So a prophet is not master of his prophecies. God is their master, and he gives them as he will, even to those whom we would call a prophet. And remember, a prophet, it used to distress me in the theological college where I was, that a prophet was merely a forth teller, F-O-R-T-H, a forth teller, a forthright teller. That is, a person who didn't mince words. Well, that's pretty good. They were that. Just think of Elijah, the way he spoke to Ahab. "Thou art he that troubleth Israel." He didn't mince words there, did he, you know? We would agree with that, but where they disagreed was the prophet was not a foreteller, F-O-R-E, a foreteller. And so when they came to Isaiah, they had to chop him up. There was Isaiah 1 and Isaiah 2 and Isaiah 3 and many in the 3. And the reason was, nothing spiritual, how could that part of Isaiah... How could the first part know what took place later on? It must have been another Isaiah. And they just argued from that. It doesn't matter. That was their view. Prophet is a foreteller as well, with deep understanding. And the man of God sent unto the king of Israel, saying, "Beware that thou pass not such a place, for thither the Syrians have come down." So there's the information. And the king of Israel sent to the place which the man of God told him, and warned him of, and saved himself there, not once, nor twice. So this kind of information, which was to the king of Syria and a few, somehow seemed to reach the king of Israel, because every time he seemed to escape injury or any harm to himself or to his soldiers or to his people. And this could have happened once quite easily, but it happens twice. You think that's strange? It happens three times. You have to take notice, and the king of Syria is concerned. Therefore, the heart of the king of Syria was sore troubled. He was not only troubled, he was very, very worried. Sore troubled for this thing. And he called his servants and said unto them, "Will he not show me which of us is not for the king of Israel?" I want to know how many of you are against the king of Israel, so that I might discover who's for him. Because somebody is telling you. There is a spy amongst us, or a supporter of the king of Israel. I need to find out. Can't go on like this. And if a king in those days said that kind of thing, you know, you had to do something about it, because he could decide just to execute them all, you know, to get the one. And nobody would take him to court because he was above the law. He was the law. And one of his servants said, "None, my lord, O king." And then he says, "But Elisha." But Elisha, The Elisha, the prophet that is in Israel, telleth the king of Israel the words that thou speakest in thy bedchamber. This Elisha has got that kind of knowledge. But I know also, he says, who is his informant. You see, he said, O king, but Elisha the prophet in Israel telleth the king of Israel the words that thou speakest in thy bedchamber. This is the one. Now that was a baffling thing. How can you fight against such knowledge? How can you oppose such a man? But a man who understands force will only answer a problem with force, you know. If he sees it, always use the execution or prison or torture or armies or wars or cruelties. That's the only thing he understands. And if he doesn't get his own way, his own way has to be by the might of his arm. The only way that he's kept his kingdom subdued to him, the only way that he's subdued other kingdoms as well, is the way that has always worked. And that is through the strength of flesh, the strength of man. And he said, go and spy where he is, that I may send and fetch him. And it was told him, saying, behold, he is in Dothan. Now look at his command. Therefore sent he the horses and chariots and a great host against one man. Can you imagine it? The thing really is quite ridiculous. Against one man. And they came by night and compassed the city about. So here now in Dothan, poor old Dothan, they are surrounded by an incredible, vast army of foot soldiers and chariots and horsemen and cavalry. All these people are there. The servant of the man of God was risen early. And notice how frightening it must have been. They came by night and they keep silent vigil. Can you imagine? There's something creepy and uncanny about that. Surrounded the whole of the city. There will be no hope for that city. It will be completely, utterly destroyed. But they wait silently surrounding the city. But the servant of the man of God got up early and gone forth, behold, and a host compassed the city, both with horses and chariots. And the servant said unto him, alas, my master, how shall we do? What can we do? Alas, my master. This is really the whole point of this part. And he answered, fear not. That's the first thing. Now, we've looked at this, haven't we, in other accounts as well, particularly in the account, remember, of Jehoshaphat, when a word came to him in the surrounding, I don't know how many armies were coming against little Judah at that time. And remember the word that came through the servants of God to the king there was, fear not, you have not got to fight in this battle. Why say fear not first? Because that is the thing that happens to us. Very easily we are frightened. We're all like that. There are no exceptions to this. If something is about us that is stronger than us, greater than us, much more power than us, much more authority than us, and threatens us, we are frightened, aren't we? We are frightened. We may get over it if we're very brave, but we are frightened. The prophet, however, knows more, and he says to the servant, now, don't be afraid. And then he tells him a very strange thing. For they that be with us are more than they that be with them. Now, has that ever occurred to you? Let me give you a kind of a parallel. Here tonight, when we're singing and praising, expounding the word, have you ever thought there are two congregations here? When we meet on the Sabbath day, I'm very aware of it, you know? And I love it, I revel in it. there are two congregations. We are helped by angels. We often refer to it in hymns, and I wonder if we ever notice these hymns. Angels, remember, help us to adore him. We join with them and they with us in the adoration of God. We, in our feeble little human way, yet in some strange way, we join in the adoration of God, of the church on earth and the church in heaven, together, two congregations. It makes it a spiritual thing. So you see, we are not lecturing. We don't need to have amusing things. We don't need distractions, because we're doing something spiritual. Do you remember in the woman of Samaria, where she is told by our blessed Savior, he says, they that worship God, worship him in spirit and in truth. There's something very beautiful and silent and spiritual in that. And the Father seeketh such to worship him. He says, fear not, for greater are they, for they that be with us are more than they that be with them. Now this was a puzzle to his young servants. He could understand, and I'm sure he would nod in approval, that this was true in a spiritual sense. And he thought, yes, oh, Elijah is such a good man. He's such a spiritual man, and he knows that God is with him, and he's just telling me not to be afraid. I would accept it as almost a pious kind of platitude. Yes, of course, if God be for us, who can be against us? I'm sure he would respond in that kind of way, because he has to have more. And Elisha prayed and said, Lord, I pray thee, open his eyes that he may see. Now he wasn't blind, remember, but open his eyes that he may see. And the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw. And behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire round about Elisha. There's her picture. It's a very lovely one, a very wonderful one. I recall in my first church where it was a different kind of situation. Church itself would not pretend to be evangelical, but would confess to being a higher critical and a liberal church. And I think that if I had said that any other church in the town, apart from one small cause, the main big churches, which are all Welsh churches, I don't think any one of them would have enjoyed you calling them evangelical. They would freely admit that they were liberal churches. Unless you use the word evangelical in a looser sense, not in the sense of the doctrines of grace. And I can remember, and I remember the lady now, she was a convert and one of the first. I think really the hand of God was on this little lady before I came. And she worked in a little grocer shop on the corner street, right in the main part of the little town. And she said to me, do you know, she said, I feel so frightened. We are so few. I said, we are. But you know, in each of the churches, he has some of his people. Yes, she said, but we are so few. And they are so many. And I remember saying this to her. Now look, I said, you know your scriptures. I want you to do a little exercise. And I did this. I've done all sorts of funny little things in my life, and this is one of them. I said, I want you to look round. What surrounds this mining town? And she said, lovely green hills. And there were particularly beautiful hills that surrounded it. And I said, yes. And you know, those hills are full of God's heavenly host. He's watching us. And he's keeping an eye on us. We are the apple of his eye. He loves us and we belong to him. Don't be afraid. We're not on our own. And I remember saying that to her very clearly. I don't remember many events. I remember more of the unfortunate things and the hard things, I'm afraid. But that's just one of the nice little things that I remember. And she was, I hope she was encouraged. I believe she was. And she saw this, and he saw this, and they were round about Elisha. Now, why would God protect Elisha? Shall I tell you why? I believe. Now, it's very difficult when you do serve the Lord as a minister to bring this in, but nevertheless, you have to bring scripture that a servant has a special responsibility. I think he also has special protection. He has also greater responsibility in that day than another person would have, and is answerable for far more. I believe that. But yes, he receives also special protection. And perhaps we will not know until we look, when God allows us. I don't know how much we will see when we're in glory, if we want to look at anything else other than glory. But if the sharp turns and twists of of life's journey will be shown to us, and things maybe are explained to us during life, some are not, many things happen to us, and we cannot really understand why that happened to us, then one day it will be made clear. I'm sure that is true. And many things we can look back and say, well, I can see how the Lord preserved me there. I can see how he protected me from myself. But we will be astonished at the times that we were protected and we didn't know we were. He kept us. We are kept by the power of God. Now, do we believe these things? See, way in this Old Testament, as they see Christ afar off, they are men of faith. And so he was aware that he was protected. So probably, when he woke up and saw this army round about him, he thought, well, what can they do to me? What can they do? And in the New Testament, it says that even if they kill our body, that's all they can do. That's all. Even the very worst. And when they came down to him, and they came, and can you imagine the approach now? Use your mind, and this is a real situation. And can you imagine the flags flying, or whatever they had in those days? I'm sure in those days they had things that made noise, because drums and trumpets and bugles were meant to frighten the enemy. The more noise you made, the more colour you had, the more frightening it was at that time. And they came down to him, and Elisha prayed unto the Lord and said, smite this people. That's all he said. There is a time to pray like that. Now, you might mistake this. There are times, you see, that we must discern. Yes, our hearts are full of love. Yes, we pray for the conversion of people. But you know, we have entered an age of incredible cruelty on the one hand, and of incredible sentimentality on the other. You know, both. Cruelty in the world, and a great deal of sentimentality in the church, where sometimes gross sin is overlooked rather than dealt with. I'm not saying we should be legalistic and hard. I'm not saying that. But nevertheless, you must know that your people are your people, and that your enemies who they are. And there comes a time when you say, God, deal with these people. The sternest rebuke I can remember, which absolutely amazed me, it was Douglas Macmillan, the late Douglas Macmillan. I'll not give it in its accurate detail. It was so dramatic. And to me, it was unforgettable. Now then, if somebody turns up, it was difficult and so on in a church, we obviously do your best and you try to accommodate, and that is the right thing to do. At every mission we had a man that came. I haven't seen him for many years now. And he was an absolute convinced atheist. He knew the truth. He knew it. And every mission we had, he would go amongst the people, and especially those he seemed to be able to identify, the young Christian, and bring despair to them. He had an awful ability. So when I saw him, my heart would sink. Oh no, how did he find out that we had a mission now? He'd never be about it any other time. And he had been particularly difficult. And Douglas Macmillan went right up to him. He didn't say God smite him, but he named him by what he was and told him to go. And you know, he went like a lamb and never troubled us again. Now, you may not fully agree or accept that. At first, I was disturbed. But then I realized that he had been given that knowledge that this was evil. Evil. And he dealt with it as such. Now then, we need to be, not that we see evil around every corner, not that, not to be preoccupied in that way, that would be wrong. But there are times when the opposition can be such that when it is inspired of God, we have here, he says, smite them, smite his people, I pray thee, with blindness. But I want you to notice the mercy of the prophet as well. And he smote them with blindness according to the word of Elisha. Now, to continue with the story of the minister I talked about, afterwards, he was exceedingly gracious to him. But he had exposed his sin. You know, he was not brutal with him at all. And Elisha said unto him, this is not the way, neither is this the city. Follow me, and I will bring you to the man whom we seek. But he led them to Samaria. And it came to pass, because he was telling the truth, because they were following him. And it came to pass, when they were coming to Samaria, that Elisha said, Lord, open the eyes of these men, that they may see. And the Lord opened their eyes, and they saw. And behold, they were in the midst of Samaria. They were surrounded. And the king of Israel said unto Elisha, when he saw them, my father, shall I smite them? Shall I kill them? Shall I destroy them? Notice, the prayer against them was not to destroy them, but to deal with the problem in hand. And he answered, thou shalt not smite them. Wouldst thou smite those whom thou hast taken captive with the sword and with the bow? Set bread and water before them, that they may eat and drink and go to their master. And this is an amazing thing, referring to the illustration of the Macmillan again, that before he went, he gave spiritual bread and water to him, but he brushed it aside and went. It seems to be so similar to this, an exposure of the evil and then yet showing kindness and mercy. And he prepared great provision for them. And when they had eaten and drunk, he sent them away, and they went to their master. So the bands of Syria came no more into the land of Israel. Now then, there's your story. There's the account. And it is quite a striking one and a remarkable one. The lessons there for us, that we too, we might say, so many are against us. We are so few. Even if we counted those who are truly the Lord's people in Cardiff, they are so few. And if we put that up against the religious life of Cardiff, we are so few. And if you put that up against the population of the city, we are so few. So vulnerable. So very vulnerable. And I would say here, you know, open your eyes. Open the eyes of your faith. Remember who you are. And remember who is with you. And remember that he treasures you. How much? Enough to send his son into this world that we might be his. So he's not going to waste us. He's not going to forget us. And every circumstance in our life, is precious to his heart, and we are his. And in the situation, evangelically, the word evangelical, using it now in its more biblical term, well, it is God's work and we are with him. Open our eyes. Then we look and we evangelize, yes. But there are some people, you know, who are opposed enemies of the church. There are lots of things today. There are devil worshippers. There are all sorts of organizations that are strange. And we come across them. And we must learn, when such opposition comes, to be able to rebuke them in the name of the Lord. Having done that, to say, there is a way. There is a way that we show mercy. Here the mercy is a very lovely one. So much so that it's greater than any battle that the king of Israel could have fought. You know, he didn't fight in it, did he, in this particular battle. It's greater than any. And when the king of Syria is very, very angry, it's greater than any. Now what do we learn from this? Well, in a sense we can say we are in a great spiritual battle. But the battles will be won very often in most strange ways. In ways we had not expected. In surprising ways. You know that God intervenes in a special way. He can come to us in a prayer meeting and give us a fresh insight, a new courage. He can do these things. He can do something to us that takes our fear away and our apprehension, and that we become men and women of faith, and that we recognize we are not on our own. We are God's people. We are his people and the sheep of his pasture. Now, I don't want to finish this without saying, it is not often that you have somebody so evil that you have to say anything. You have bad people, wicked people. Of course, you preach the gospel to them. But there are people, you know. There are Satanists. There are groups like that, you know. And all I'm saying is that when they begin to interfere with the work of God, that we call on God. We call on God. We are not saying they can never be saved. We can't say that. We can put still, as it did here, bread and water to them. But in as far as their activities are concerned, we resist them. We are told to resist Satan. And what will he do? Do you remember? He will flee from you. Let us be full of love, full of mercy, full of grace. Strong, gentle, but not soft. Not sentimental. There's a great difference between sentimentality and love and doing the right thing. And here we have these examples by these remarkable men. Lonely, very, very lonely men, standing on their own. And even seen amongst God's people, so much carelessness as well. And yet when they speak so well. He doesn't seem to say a lot, does he? He just said regarding this, when he went to, regarding the man who'd lost his axe, he just picked it up and he said, take it. He said, where did it fall? Take it. And here he says, fear not, don't be afraid. There are more with us than are with them. And he sees trouble still on this poor servant's face. He said, oh, you're still bothered, aren't you? Then I'll pray for you. Lord, open his eyes. Open his eyes of faith that he might see. And then he has a prayer that he can ask. Deal with these, Lord. They're opposing thy servants. They're opposing thy work. And even then, mercy is shown. Now shall we pray? Glorify God, and to enjoy thee forever, and to preach the gospel to every creature, for thy name's sake. Amen.